10 years since Rwanda's 1994 genocide, the country still faces the challenge of reconciliation and reconstruction. One of the hardest-hit areas of infrastructure was the Rwandan educational system. Besides the challenge of rebuilding schools and training teachers, there's also the still sensitive task of teaching the country's recent history. Rupert Cook reports.
Hundreds of children get ready to have their lunch at a school in Rwanda's capital, Kigali. Rwanda's 1994 genocide devastated the country's already inadequate educational system. Many teachers were killed, others participated in the genocide. In the intervening decade, much has been done to rebuild the country's schools and teaching capacity. Yet there remain considerable challenges. John Rutayisiri is director of Rwanda's National Curriculum Development Center.
You will know, I'm sure as much as I do, that education in Rwanda before 1994 was used to divide Rwandese people in terms of teaching history, in terms of teaching civic education, where differences rather than similarities were emphasized in the schools. The challenge now is to use the same education to turn around and make education and life meaningful to Rwandese children and the Rwandese society. So the first point and the first starting point has been to create awareness among Rwandans so they can be aware of the distortions of the colonial education and colonial history. And now it is time to get Rwandans and friends of Rwanda to sit together and write what I consider to be an objective history of this country.
Inculcating an objective and impartial view of the past is crucial for Rwanda's future. Alois Habimana is program officer for the Rwandan League for the Promotion and Defense of Human Rights.
I know that there is a tendency of trying sometimes to rewrite history. I think people should be honest. When you talk about history, there should not be any manipulation at all. If you want to really build a peaceful country, differences in ethnic groups should not really be a cause of problems, rather a cause of unity and a cause to make people complement one another. This is a very important thing people should think about.
Well, I'm in Green Hills Academy, which is in Kigali, and it's a private school of around 1,000 pupils. It's one of the best schools, apparently, in the whole country. I'm just about to come into the Senior 6 Arts classroom. This is a small class, and these students are preparing for their final examinations before they go off to university. Okay, Sandy, what do you learn about reconciliation?
We learn that we have to forgive one another and not necessarily revenge in the same way that they did the genocide. We're taught not to mind about your tribe. You just value the competence, don't value the tribes or anything else.
Oliver, what have you learned about the genocide? What mistakes were made in the past?
Actually, the most mistake which were made was focusing on the ethnic group. Now they're trying to... We're trying to change. We're studying that ethnic group is no matter, that we all human. We should try to work together.
Do you think that all the pupils here, they accept it?
For young people, I think it's easier to accept it because they are taught to accept that. But for older people, I think it's hard because they grew up teaching them by, you know, the different ethnic groups, and that I think it's easier for the younger generation.
These Green Hills students are among the best in the country. Their relative detachment from issues of ethnicity may bode well for the future. Yet the fault lines evidently run deep. Joseph Yedder teaches history at Green Hills Academy.
When you are teaching, you can't talk about ethnic groups. Yet at times in history, you need to mention them because it is a reality. But when you are talking about it, you have to be very sensitive. Not just a matter of mentioning. There are some students, for example, whom we may be teaching, and they lost their people during the genocide. So when you are talking about either genocide, you must talk about it, but when you are not hurting the other student, because you may hurt the student, he will start crying in class, and he may fail to teach.
Pupils' sensitivity highlights the dilemma in which the Rwandan authorities find themselves over the teaching of history. The government is determined to suppress the potential for ethnic division. Last year, it enacted various legislation which outlawed ethnic divisionism and sectarianism. Yet supposed ethnic difference between Tutsis and Hutus may be central to any understanding of the country's recent past. Klaas de Jonge works with international NGO Penal Reform International in Kigali. He's done extensive research on the aftermath of Rwanda's genocide.
If you want to deal with ethnicity, you should discuss it. It's impossible at this moment, it's taboo. So they are very sensitive questions. It was a power struggle, but ethnicity was used, and we see it often misused in this way all over the world. And it should be dealing with, not by saying we're all the same, but by trying, how the hell did it happen? And what can we do that it doesn't happen again?
We have had ethnicity used politically, and we have seen the consequences.
Paul Kagame is president of Rwanda. A Tutsi, he's effectively led the country for the last decade after leading the then rebel Rwandan Patriotic Front, which came to power and ended the genocide in 1994.
Now, we are trying to say, why don't we do something else? Why don't we allow this diversity to be there as it is there, but also understand that there's something we can do for the common good, that we can bring these perceptions of differences to work for the better, at least for all of us share one common thing. We share one culture. We share one country. We are the same people. Why don't we use that as a common denominator that would enable us to move forward, to move away from ethnicity, which has more or less destroyed the whole country, or almost brought extinction of a section of our population. And we are talking about that involving people. The people of Rwanda are involved. They are involved in the debates, in discussions, in discovering what went wrong so that can be avoided. You can't have a worse situation than what we have had in 1994, or years before, of a section of our population. And we are talking about that involving people. The people of Rwanda are involved. They are involved in the debates, in discussions, in discovering what went wrong so that can be avoided. You can't have a worse situation than what we have had in 1994 or years before. I believe things can only get better. They can't get worse.
Besides the challenge of negotiating Rwanda's recent history, the country's schools must also deal with another very real and present threat. Rwanda has been hard hit by the HIV/AIDS epidemic. As a consequence, schools have also introduced mandatory classes tackling such issues as HIV/AIDS prevention as well as human rights.
What about HIV/AIDS? What do you learn about in terms of HIV/AIDS?
We learn, of course, it's a very serious disease affecting most of African countries, especially developing countries, and obviously affecting Rwanda. So they teach us, we are aware about such diseases, about AIDS especially. Yeah.
And how do you prevent HIV/AIDS?
The best way to prevent HIV/AIDS, I think, is abstinence. Abstinence, or if you need it, you can use condoms, I think.
What about the whole issue of human rights? What do you learn about human rights?
About human rights, we learned about to be equal, to not to be like a man, to be more maybe educated more than a woman, and we learn about it and that we have to be equal, woman and man, and everything is going to be okay.
For Common Ground, I'm Rupert Cook in Kigali, Rwanda.
The indigenous peoples of Africa, otherwise known as Pygmies, were in the second half of the 20th century largely driven from their traditional communities in the continent's forests. This was often done in the name of environmental conservation, as vast swaths of land were declared national parks. In Rwanda, the Twa, or Pygmy people, shared such a fate, with disastrous consequences for the whole community. This was compounded by the Rwandan genocide, which saw the Twa population decline by a third. Increasingly, though, there is the realization, far from being a threat to conservation, that the Twa could help safeguard their traditional environment. Rupert Cook continues his report from the heart of Rwanda's jungle.
Ismail is a community leader of the Twa minority in the village of Biyeye in southern Rwanda, close to the border with neighboring Burundi. In Rwanda's native language, Kinyarwanda, Twa is an adjective referring to the whole community, while Mutwa is the singular form and Batwa the plural. Here he's describing how his people were driven by the army from nearby forests in the 1960s. Today, the Twa community ekes out a living at the very lowest rungs of Rwandan poverty. Most families can't afford to send their children to school, and maternal and infant mortality is high. In Biyeye, the Batwa live separately from the other two ethnic groups of Rwanda, the majority Hutus and minority Tutsis. This tale of loss and alienation is replayed across Rwanda, in ramshackle villages where the Batwa live in hope of returning to the nearby forests. Anicet Demyeye is a Twa community leader in Rwanda.
According to the anthropologist, the Batwa were the first inhabitants of this country. And when they were pulled out of the forest, anything was done for them because there was no compensation, no land for them. You see, for example, to have something to eat, they must go from here to other place to ask something for it or to do some jobs.
The Batwa were expelled from the forests in the name of environmental conservation. In the second half of the last century, as the mainly Western conservation movement gained an impetus, similar stories of forced expulsion of indigenous peoples from newly created national parks were common across the African continent. John Nelson is a policy advisor with international NGO, the Forest Peoples Programme, which works to safeguard the rights of indigenous people globally.
I think what we're concerned is that these people are not being given a choice of whether or not they want to lose their old ways of life, whether or not they want to lose their culture. Their culture will disappear, and their traditional knowledge about forest issues will be lost. There is a significant correlation between the location of these hunting and gathering forest-based communities and high biodiversity, and this is yet to be explored fully.
Increasingly, over the last decade, there's been a growing realization among environmentalists that far from hindering conservation efforts, indigenous peoples can do much to help safeguard wildlife in their traditional environment, namely the forests. After millennia of living in relative equilibrium with their natural surroundings, the Batwa are better placed than most to assist in the management of the national parks. Vince Smith is country representative in Rwanda for the NGO, the Diane Fossey Gorilla Fund.
Looking at the question of whether minority peoples could return to the forest, it's a valid point to say that where there are minority peoples living in protected areas, the animals tend to be harvested, if you like, or culled or hunted sustainably. And that in areas where you've actually removed indigenous peoples, you tend to find that the wildlife as a whole has suffered. When indigenous peoples are hunting in the park and living in protected areas, should I say, it's in their interest to do this sustainably.
Despite signs of some changing attitudes among environmentalists, the Batwa face an uphill struggle against an array of challenges. Perhaps worst of all, they were, and often still are, the victims of virulent racism. Many Rwandans consider the Batwa to be quite literally an inferior people, not on the same level of humanity. Twa activist Anicet Demyeye.
When some people passed near my house, they say, "Do you see? It is a house for a Mutwa." In the place where I am, because they know that I am Mutwa, they try to say, "We can't understand how this Mutwa can have a house, can have something which is good." You see, because it's something they can't understand, because they know that a Mutwa can't do anything. Now, what we are trying to do We want to show other communities that we are able to do everything. What is missing for us, it is the means. If we can have some means like other people, we can do everything.
I'm in Kanigi. It's a small village near the town of Ruwengeri in the north of Rwanda, very close to the border with Congo, very close also to the national park known as the Virungas, which has now become a centre of conservation for gorillas. And I've come to a Batwa community centre, which is focused on social integration. And I'm just coming inside at the moment. Here we are. So what is actually happening here, Anicet?
Yes, here we have a small project of mushrooms, because you see our children, also the whole community, are suffering from the malnutrition. So with this small project, we have mushrooms. People can take a part of mushrooms, they can eat like food, and other part remaining, it is sold in the hotels. And with the revenue from the mushrooms, so we hope that we can do something, for instance, for assist the children or to assist community to have some care.
Although there is among Twa community leaders a determination to achieve a greater degree of self-sufficiency, projects such as the one at Kanigi tend to be the exception rather than the rule. And the Batwa remain a highly marginalised, if not endangered, minority. Charles Werye is a leading figure in the Rwandan Twa community.
All the Batwa have been just removed from the forest. Now they are living on the margins of the forest. Now, even just collecting firewood, it's a problem for them, because when they are found, they are either charged money or they are imprisoned, or sometimes they can even disappear. If the situation remains like this, that is poverty, illiteracy, discriminated against, surely we are going even to be extinct.
While some environmentalists are increasingly recognizing the need to involve indigenous people in the protection of their ancestral homelands, much work remains to be done. John Nelson from the Forest Peoples Program.
Valuation of wild species over human beings is one that's very difficult to make, but it seems that, well, conservation organizations can tell you all about what animals are doing in the forest, but they can't actually tell you about the human population who are living on the same lands as these animals and have done so for millennia.
For Common Ground, I'm Rupert Cook in Kigali, Rwanda.